My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. Tuesday, June 4th, will mark the 100th anniversary of the passing of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The amendment, which was ratified on August 18, 1920, granted women, but not all women, the right to vote. This right was called women's suffrage. It wasn't until the Civil Rights Act of 1965 that all women, including African-American women in many parts of the South and many indigenous women, finally achieved this right. Today, nearly 200 years after women began speaking out for equality, we still find a society where many women are struggling for their rights, are often met with sexism and misogyny, and still find the proverbial glass ceiling inhibiting their full pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness. Are there lessons that women of the 21st century can learn from the original suffragists of the 19th century? Can examining their struggle offer new inspiration for today's women and also open the hearts and minds of men? My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, April Young Bennett, did just that. April Young Bennett began studying the lives of suffragists to inform her own activism. As communication director for Voices for Utah Children, she worked within nationwide networks of advocates for changes to state and federal policies affecting children and parents, such as pay equity, healthcare, education, and juvenile justice. April Young Bennett was a founding organizer and spokesperson for the activist group Ordained Women, which has been featured in respected news outlets such as the New York Times and the Washington Post. Ordained Women collaborates with the Women's Ordination Conference, Ordained Women Now, Women of the Wall, the Parliament of World Religions Women's Task Force, and other networks of religious feminists. April produces and hosts the Religious Feminism Podcast, which provides a forum for feminists across a variety of faith communities and secular feminist organizations to learn about each other and work together toward common goals. She blogs about Mormon feminism at theexponent.com, which averages 40,000 unique visitors per month. She joins me this week to discuss her new book, Ask a Suffragist, Stories and Wisdom from America's First Feminists. Please join me in welcoming to Destination Unlimited, April Young Bennett. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing this very important work that you do.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here.
Now, please share with our listeners a little bit about your path and how you became an activist.
It started quite some time ago. I became involved in many different secular issues as an advocate for children. But as an advocate for children, I found that often I needed to also advocate for women like myself, because many issues that affect children are those that are affecting their mothers, their caretakers. So if women aren't paid equally with men, then their own children suffer. That was one way I became involved. Another is I became involved in Mormon feminism, feminism within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Within my church, we still have an all-male priesthood, and so women are still barred from many leadership positions, and that leads to many inequities within our community. And so I became involved in starting an organization called Ordained Women, where we sought to let the brethren, the leaders of our church, know that we are ready and willing to participate with them as leaders in our church. And so we campaigned for women to also receive the priesthood and become equals with men within our religious community.
And what happened?
Well, we attracted a lot of attention, and there was a lot of support. It was exciting in many ways because at that time it was taboo to talk about women holding the priesthood and the need to ordain women within our church. And after we started advocating and having demonstrations and marches and spreading our message, it became much more common for other members of our faith to talk about this as a possibility and something that would interest them. And it even became more common for the brethren of the church to start talking about the priesthood in different ways that weren't so gendered. Unfortunately, there was also quite a bit of backlash. There were leaders of our church that singled out certain members of our activist community to punish. I was one of those people. I was singled out by my local ecclesiastical leader and went through a very difficult situation. It was the time of my brother's wedding, and within our faith community, you can't attend a religious marriage ceremony without permission from your ecclesiastical leader. And so he kind of used that wedding as an opportunity to threaten me and bar me admission to my brother's wedding unless I stepped down from my leadership role within Ordained Women. So it was a difficult time. But I did learn a lot of things about activism, and it also kind of inspired me to look back to other people who had been through this. There are many wonderful activists in history who also faced church discipline from their religious leaders. And these were wonderful people, people like Lucy Stone and Angelina Grimke, people I really admire.
You start off your book talking about a wonderful African-American woman by the name of Maria W. Stewart. Please tell us about her story.
Maria Stewart, she was the very beginning, the very start of the feminist movement in America. And I love that when we look at her history, this bold and brave woman wasn't among the educated white elite. She was a Black woman who was raised as an indentured servant. And she went out of her way to speak on behalf of women. And she did it at a time when there was a taboo against women speaking. At that time, in general throughout America, there was a belief that it was improper for women to speak to what they called promiscuous company, which simply meant groups of men and women. It was okay for women to give a speech to a bunch of other women. And of course, it was okay for men to speak to anyone they wanted to. But it was considered improper for a woman to give a speech with men in the audience. And she was the first person of that time period to break that taboo and to announce that she was going to hold public speeches where she was going to talk about women's rights, not only to women, but to men as well.
And the admonition that many used actually stemmed from 1 Corinthians 14:34 when St. Paul made a statement. What was that statement supposed to be?
Let your women keep silent.
Now, there's been some historical research, and scholars say that that actually was not in the original words of St. Paul. That was something that was added on later. Have you found that also?
Yes, there are many scholars who believe that. At that time, though, this was in the 1830s, and that kind of scholarship didn't exist at that time. So the common prevailing wisdom among their people, their Christian people, was that Paul doesn't want women to speak.
And what was Maria W. Stewart's response to that?
She said that she wasn't worried about Paul. She thought that if Paul were around at that time and he could see what women were going through, he would understand. He would say, never mind, go ahead and speak your minds. People need to hear this.
So you wrote this wonderful book, Ask a Suffragist. How is Ask a Suffragist different than traditional history textbooks or biographies?
As an activist, one thing that I found is that great movements aren't usually built by solitary heroes. They're built by communities of rank and file workers. And some of those workers do develop name recognition and become well known. But the vast majority are people that you've never heard of who are working behind the scenes and doing wonderful things which really make a difference. And so when we read traditional history books, when we read traditional history books, unfortunately, we usually don't hear a lot about women and about their struggles because they tend to focus more on men. But when we do read about women, we tend to focus on the most famous women. And those women, many of them were great people who did great things, but there were so many working with them. And my book makes it a point to bring out the stories of these other women who maybe aren't so well known. Another thing about my book that's different is that I've organized it around questions I, as a modern activist, would have for my foremothers, for the people who started the feminist movement. So in each chapter, I raise a question that I have that I would want to ask the people who came before me as an activist to get their advice. And I focus on what those women can teach me.
So in essence, what you're doing is creating a dialogue, literally a 200-year-old dialogue, between yourself and your, shall we say, the four mothers who went forward bringing this message out in those days.
Exactly. I'm asking them my questions.
And what are the types of answers that you're getting?
They're telling me to make myself heard, and they're talking about different ways we can do that. They're also not all giving the same advice. Just like today, there are many differences of opinion, and there's many different ways of reaching your goals, and they don't necessarily have to be the same. Different people will have different approaches, and that doesn't mean that different approaches can't work. There isn't one right way.
My guest is April Young Bennett. She's the author of Ask a Suffragist, Stories and Wisdom from America's First Feminist. We'll be back with more of April Young Bennett after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Hi, this is Julie Geigel.
And I'm Susan Schuler.
And I'm Lori Walker.
And we are
the Psychic Angel Channelers
from Angel Talk Tuesday.
Tune in every week at 10 a.m. Eastern on OMTimesRadio.com.
The angels have heard your call and are here to help.
Are you ready to receive?
Bathe in the beautiful vibrational frequency to help you heal, expand, and remember your magnificence with Angel Talk Tuesday.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with, all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is! Oh, and get this, she even talks to it. Last week she asked it for Chinese, and guess what? Egg rolls showed up, like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and theshelterpetproject.org.
Adopt US Kids presents Multiple Choice Parenting.
You've accidentally cut your daughter's bangs unevenly. Do you A, line things up a centimeter from her hairline?
Man, oh man, oh man, oh man, oh man!
No, 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 no. Sweatbands are so hot right now. Everyone's wearing them. Like that basketball player and that other basketball player.
B, get spiritual.
Mom, where did all the mirrors go?
A reflection could never capture our true selves.
Huh?
Beauty is within.
C, look on the bright side.
Less time blow drying, more time texting.
Or D, show empathy.
Mom, you really don't have
Ta-da! To... Twinsies!
I kinda love it. As a parent, there are no perfect answers. But you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same.
For more information, contact You Gotta Believe at YouGottaBelieve.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is April Young Bennett. She's the author of the new book, Ask a Suffragist, Stories and Wisdom from America's First Feminist. Why did you choose the suffragist you featured in this book?
There were so many different women and men who contributed to the movement when it first began. There were many people to choose from. And my goal was not to provide one right way of living for anyone, but rather to get lots of different perspectives. And so I looked for people who had different backgrounds and different points of view. So some of the women, several of the women in my book are women of color. There are several immigrants in my book, people who came to the United States with other backgrounds, other ideas from the countries they came from that brought those in with them to our American movement. And there's people of different socioeconomic statuses. There are people who are former slaves who lived in poverty. There are also people who grew up very wealthy, and I would say maybe in some ways spoiled, who discovered feminism later on in life as their circumstances changed. And so it's interesting for me to see many different points of view, because there's many different ways to be a feminist.
You use the word suffragists. Why suffragists and not suffragettes? What's the difference?
I wish I could use the word suffragette, because that is so much easier for me to say without sounding like I have a lisp. Suffragist is a little bit awkward, but that is what American feminists called themselves. Suffragettes was more commonly used among British women.
And the adding of the E-T-T-E also implies women, right? As opposed to men.
Yes. However, in America, there were many men involved in the suffrage movement.
So suffragist would be the appropriate way of saying it for the United States, for America.
That's right.
Now, how did the American women's rights movements begin?
It largely began with women who were excited about being activists within other movements other than suffrage, particularly the abolition of slavery and the end of alcoholism. Those were two issues that were a very big deal to many women of this time period, and they wanted to make their voices heard on these issues that were important to them. However, that was difficult. They couldn't vote. There was this big taboo against them speaking in public, and many men who were activists didn't want to involve women in their groups. They considered it improper for women to even be there. And so they found that if they wanted to support other issues that they cared about, first of all, they needed to support their own right to speak out and to basically be part of this conversation.
And what are some of the barriers that suffragists had to confront?
One of the biggest barriers is something we already talked about, and that was this taboo against women speaking in public. If women couldn't make their voices heard, if they weren't allowed to talk to other people, they couldn't make a difference. And so that was one big barrier that they had to address right from the very start. Another is a barrier that they had in common with everyone of their time, and that was that communication was difficult. And back in the 1830s, 1840s, the idea that women should be equal was so new that there just weren't that many people that they could communicate with and work with to begin with. And they had to somehow find them without the help of the internet. As a modern activist, when I first became involved in activist causes, I didn't know anyone in my local neighborhood who felt the same way I did. But I was very quickly able to find other like-minded people by going online, talking to other people on social media. And now I have a broad network I can talk to. They didn't have that. And so they had to find other ways to reach out and find people who felt the same way they did, so they would have allies to work with.
Now, I noticed in your book, there's a lot of references to letters between members of the suffragists movement. Was letter writing something that was their way of communicating with each other as opposed to the internet today?
Yes. They carried on long conversations with each other over letter. And if you actually take a look at those letters and set them side by side, you'll see them holding conversations the same way we might, say, via chat. Someone will ask someone a question, and then in the next letter, that person will answer them. But of course, because they were doing a long, slow process, they would have to put, say, many questions and many answers in one letter. And then they would receive a letter back that had many responses and many more questions for them. And they would continue back and forth like that. And they corresponded often. And so one of the wonderful things about that is we can really hear their voices today, because there is so much correspondence. You can see how they talked to each other, how they brainstormed and developed ideas together.
Now, you had mentioned the prohibition against women speaking in public, especially to mixed male and female groups, many of them to advocate against slavery and against the issues of the day, actually had their own gatherings where only women would attend and they would speak. Is that correct?
That's right. That was one of the strategies they came up with to kind of deal with this prohibition. They found that many men's groups that were already in place would not let them participate. And so they simply formed their own groups and started doing their own activities. And many of these women's abolition groups were very strong advocates for the abolition of slavery. And they would raise money, they'd hold fundraising bazaars, and they would earn money for the cause. They did certain boycotts against goods that were coming from slave labor. They did a lot of good work together that really attracted attention.
How much of their activity was able to get to the pre-Civil War South, if any at all?
You know, it was difficult for them to talk to the people in the South because lots of things happened to prevent that. Two people in particular who are from the South, Angelina and Sarah Grimke, were wonderful voices, and they actually wrote treatises intended for their former neighbors in the South. And they tried to get their attention by writing directly to these people they grew up with. And in their hometown, they actually had a legal ban on anyone reading anything they wrote. And if it came in the mail from the North, they would immediately burn it instead of sending it on. So it was difficult for people in the South to hear what they were saying.
We had talked about a little bit about Maria W. Stewart and her activism. Who were some of the other women of color that contributed to the American suffrage movement?
One of the most well-known is Sojourner Truth. Sojourner Truth grew up in slavery, but not in the South. She grew up in slavery in the North, in New York, before it was abolished there. And during her time as a slave, she was a woman who had such a drive. She was so inspired to speak out for her rights, even without the opportunities that many other people had of an education or of money. She was in poverty, but she was determined to have her rights. In fact, she took her former owner to court to sue for the freedom of her son, and she won against white people, even though she wasn't educated and she didn't have all that background. And so she was one person who made a big stand for both abolition and for women's rights. Another one is Frances Ellen Watkins Harper. And she was a poet. And she wrote poetry kind of like the slam poetry we have today, where the poetry is meant to be performed. And she would perform the poetry, and it would be so inspiring that she got big audiences of both white and black people to listen to her message.
So she was the first rapper.
Yes, yeah.
That's wonderful. And that was what year?
That would have been in the 1860s. So, well, 1850s, 1860s, right before the Civil War. There were many other activists at that time. One big family of African-Americans was the Purvis and Fortin family. Their two last names, lots of intermarriage between the Purvis and the Fortin family, and there were many of them that became, both the men and the women, became very strong activists. And they were based in Philadelphia. They worked with some white people, such as Lucretia Mott, and they formed the first Philadelphia Female Anti-Slavery Society, which became a very strong organ in favor of abolition, and also in favor of women's rights, because their group came to find that if they wanted to accomplish anything, they needed to end some of these silly prohibitions against women sending in petitions to Congress, for example, or women giving public speeches. And so they expanded their platform not only to cover abolition, but also to cover women's rights, because they believed that women should have a voice in this platform.
Wonderful. My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, April Young Bennett. She's the author of Ask a Suffragist, Stories and Wisdom from America's First Feminist. April, please tell our listeners where they can get your book, also the special offer that you have on your new book, and also where they can find out more about you and this amazing work.
If you go to askasuffragist.com, you can find links there to purchase the book. And the special offer that I have now for anyone who buys it during this first month of sales through the end of June, if you send an email to april@apryoungbee.com, then with the words Illustrated Companion in the subject line, I will send you a free e-copy of an Illustrated Companion to the guide. So you can, that Illustrated Companion includes pictures of the people and the places and the events that transpire in the book, so you can see what it actually looks like. And it also includes discussion questions for your book club or your activist organization.
And I'm sure your book is found at places where all great books are sold.
Absolutely. Where all great books are sold.
Including Amazon.com, right?
Of course.
And we'll be back with more of April Young Bennett and Ask a Suffragist after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
This is OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Are you in an interfaith relationship and thinking of getting married? For 18 years, Reverend Lori Sue Brockway has been creating personalized, loving, and romantic ceremonies for couples of all faiths and cultural backgrounds. Reverend Lori Sue's sensitivity to the needs of interfaith couples is reflected in the compassionate and inclusive way she addresses the concerns of parents and families. Reverend Lori Sue is also the author of several best-selling books on interfaith weddings and wedding vows. Selected as one of the top interfaith officiants by New York Magazine, Reverend Lori Sue serves couples in the New York metropolitan area and beyond. Find out more at her website, yourinterfaithwedding.com.
Wake up and text. Text and eat. Mm-mm. Text and catch the bus. Text and miss your stop.
Wait.
Text and be late to work.
Sorry, I'm late.
Text and work. Text and pretend to work. Text and act surprised when someone calls you out for not working.
Who, me?
Text and meet up with a friend you haven't seen in forever.
Hi.
Oh, hey.
Text and complain that they're on their phone the whole time. Text and listen to them complain that you're on your phone the whole time.
Ugh.
Text and whatever. But when you get behind the wheel, give your phone to a passenger. Put it in the glove box. Just don't text and drive. Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Tune in to The Practical Intuitive, Mind, Body, Spirit for the Real World, with me, host Robin Fritz, Mondays at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 Eastern. I'll cover personal and business intuition, animal communication, mediumship, space clearing, past life regression, shamanic insights, energy healing, soul choice, and more, all to help you tap your own intuitive and healing skills. No ifs, ands, or buts.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the Lingo.
GOAT, G-O-A-T, acronym, stands for Greatest of All Time. As in, spaghetti sandwiches for dinner? They're my fave. Dad, you're the GOAT.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org, brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Bill Maher. I can find humor in almost anything, but one thing I never laugh about is cruelty to animals. If you don't get the joke either, write People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, 501 Front Street, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week, April Young Bennett. She's the author of the new book, Ask a Suffragist, Stories and Wisdom from America's First Feminists. April, in the last segment, we talked about women of color who contributed to the American suffrage movement. How about immigrants? Who were the immigrants who contributed?
One of the most important was Ernestine Rose. She came from Poland. And she had some interesting experiences while she was in Poland that really affected her views, and she brought those views with her to America. One was that at a young age, when she was only 17, she was betrothed against her will to an older man. And while she said she was not going to go through the wedding and she refused to be married for any reason other than love, and especially not to someone older than her who would probably treat her like a daughter instead of like an equal partner, she fought him in court for the right to keep her property as her betrothed. He had a right to basically confiscate her property. And she went to court and she won. And oddly, after winning and proving her point, she left most of that property behind and left Poland. And then she went to England, where she became involved with the Owenite movement. And Owenites had lots of wonderful ideas, which we now do take largely into consideration when we're looking at social work and social issues, where they didn't want to go out and punish individuals. They wanted to look at what's going on in their backgrounds, in their lives, and in these communities that's causing social problems to exist. It's a way which today we do think about social problems that way, and we do try to find the root causes instead of just punishing one individual. But at that time, it was a brand new thought. And then she came across the ocean to America, and she brought this background with her. So as soon as she came to America, she found out that her husband, at that time she had married someone of her own choice, and named William Rose, and she liked him a lot, but she still didn't want him to own her property. And when she got to America, she found that the rules here weren't any better than they were in Poland, that married women were not considered to have property rights. Everything they owned was considered to belong to their husbands. And so she started a campaign almost unilaterally by herself to get women property rights. She also brought those wonderful ideas about community and about addressing social problems from the root that she learned in England with her to America.
When did women earn property rights in the United States?
Ernestine Rose, along with a few other women like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Paulina Wright, after about 10 years of work, they did manage to have some success in New York. And eventually that started spreading to other places in the 1850s.
That's incredible that a woman would not be entitled to own the property that her husband had amassed should he pass. It's something that's even unthinkable today, isn't it?
Yes. And when you read Elizabeth Cady Stanton's writings on the topic, she thought it was just outrageous, and she was pretty sarcastic about it. She made a lot of fun of them when they finally did pass the law that gave women their rights, about how now a woman was considered, who was smart enough to actually earn money and put it in the bank, was now considered at last smart enough to also take it out of the bank.
Amazing.
She thought that was pretty hilarious that it took them that long to come to that realization.
Amazing. How did men contribute to or hinder the suffrage movement?
Many of the first feminists in America were men. And largely the reason why they became interested in feminism is because they cared about the issues women cared about, like abolition, that women wanted to get involved in. And they realized that they needed more hands. They needed more people. It was all hands on deck. There was no reason to exclude women who were smart and bright and energetic and willing to contribute to the cause. And so there were certain men like Samuel May and William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass who very desperately wanted to involve women, and they became passionate supporters of women's rights because they wanted women involved in these important causes that they cared about. Unfortunately, there were also other men who were worried that if women got involved, it would just upset the order of things and all their work that they had been doing would somehow come crashing down. And so, unfortunately, there were also many men who were abolitionists who opposed involving women and opposed women's rights. So it went both ways. One person that's very interesting to me is Arthur Tappan. And the reason why is because Arthur Tappan was both a wonderful advocate for women's rights and a huge problem when it came to women's rights. When it came to the issue of women in education, he was a passionate supporter of education for women. And in fact, there was a time when Prudence Crandall was a woman who tried to start a school for Black female teenagers in Connecticut. And she ran into so much hatred and vitriol, and Arthur Tappan kind of swooped in and came to the rescue. She was actually arrested because she was teaching Black teenagers in her school. And Arthur Tappan came in, and he was a wealthy philanthropist. He had money, and he funded her defense, her legal defense. And thanks to that funding, they did win. He also funded an entire public relations campaign for her. So he was an active supporter of the right of young Black women to get an education. However, when it came to the Abolition Society, he was not so great. In fact, he exited the Abolition Society the first time they voted for a woman to be an officer.
Why?
He just didn't see that as their place. He thought that it was great for women to get an education, but not so great for them to use it by telling men what to do.
Mm-hmm. Were other people charged or prosecuted who were part of the movement?
Yes. One of those was William Lloyd Garrison. In that same incident, he was brought to court for supporting Prudence Crandall and supporting her school for Black children. And there were other occasions when he was brought to jail because of that. Later on than in my book, you'll hear lots of stories of women who were brought to jail because of their support for suffrage.
How was activism during the 19th century different from modern activism, and how is it similar?
It's not as different as one might think. At first, when I became an activist, I didn't know the history very well, and I didn't care very well because I thought the world was completely different now that we have the internet and TV and we can talk to each other in different ways. But really, many of the things that we do today, like signing petitions and giving speeches and holding protests, those are all things that they were doing back in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, things that people have been doing for a long time because they work.
Did the activists in those days have access to printing presses?
They did. Printing was more expensive, though. But yes, they did. Printing was a big thing that they did a lot. But it was also a big problem for them because funding. Printing is expensive. One of the luxuries that we enjoy today is that we can post things on the internet virtually for free. Often it is free to just post something up there and make a statement. That wasn't the case back then. They did depend on printing, and printing was very expensive. And funding was always a problem. One of the reasons Susan B. Anthony became involved in addressing the wage gap and addressing the issue of women being allowed to be in men-only professions was because she became so frustrated because they could not fund their advocacy campaigns. She noticed that women really cared about these causes. They cared about stopping alcoholism. They cared about ending slavery. But they would run out of money, and then they couldn't do anything. And she said, women need a purse of their own.
And what about political activity? Was there any hidden political activity taking place at the time?
There was a great deal of political activity. One of the ironies is that when the abolition movement first began, people like Lucretia Mott and William Lloyd Garrison, who were some of the very first advocates for women's rights, were so disgusted by politics that they said, we're just going to boycott politics altogether. And so at first, they weren't even interested in women voting because they didn't want to vote. They didn't want anyone to vote. They thought that the best way to end all of this slavery and all of the horrible things that the government was allowing to happen was to abstain from the government altogether, just to put your foot down and say, no, I will have nothing to do with this. Now, that wasn't a really effective method of changing law. And other people who came along afterwards, like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Elizabeth Cady Stanton was one of the first people to say women should vote, because she really felt like if we're going to change the laws, we need to be involved, not abstaining.
And I had mentioned to you prior to the interview that my wife and I had the pleasure of visiting the Cady Stanton home and also the site of the first Women's Rights Convention in 1848. Have you been there?
I have not, and I want to be there so badly. I live out in the West, so it's a little more difficult for me.
Tell us about that first convention.
It was Elizabeth Cady Stanton's idea, but it wasn't just her. It was Lucretia Mott also. Elizabeth and Lucretia were at the World Anti-Slavery Convention in London, and women were barred from the proceedings. And Lucretia was expecting that. She was there on protest. She knew women would be barred, but she was there to make a stand and say, I don't care if you're going to bar me, I'm going to show up anyway, and you're going to have to bar me to my face. Elizabeth, she was there with her husband. She was never intending to be a delegate. But when she saw what happened to the women and how they were barred, all of a sudden she had all of these ideas about how she needed to change things. And so years later, Lucretia and Elizabeth and some of their other friends got together and held a convention about women's rights. And it was kind of put together quickly. And so mostly it was just people who lived around Seneca Falls, New York, where Elizabeth Cady Stanton lived, who came. But it was many, many people who were interested. And it was an exciting event. One of the things that was the most shocking was that was where Elizabeth Cady Stanton, for the first time, made a public call for women to vote. And most people were shocked by that. But Frederick Douglass was there, and he supported it, and he moved the rest of the group to agree with Elizabeth.
My guest is April Young Bennett. She's the author of Ask a Suffragist, Stories and Wisdom from America's First Feminist. And we'll be back with more after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose: to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free. AscendingHearts.com.
Change and growth are part of natural life, and also part of your spiritual life. Everyone needs support and guidance, especially during life passages. Upgrade yourself with the OM Times Experts program. With OM Times Experts, you have access to the best intuitive coaches, spiritual teachers, counselors, astrologists, and oracles. Our team was carefully selected so you can trust. Find out more at experts.omtimes.com.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of OM Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What Is Going OM? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers, pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
1 in 3 adults in America have pre-diabetes, but most don't know it. To let people know it can be reversed before it becomes type 2 diabetes, professional basketball player Julius Randle is doing everything in reverse.
I'm only dunking with reverse windmills. I drove the whole way to practice in reverse. I don't recommend it. This move's called the reverse shuffle. I do recommend it. And it took me months to learn how to speak in reverse, like this. Here's 10 almost for diabetes type 2 with living Ben has mom my. In other words, my mom has been living with type 2 diabetes for almost 10 years. So together, we want to say to the 84 million Americans at risk, exercise and healthy eating can help reverse pre-diabetes. Start by taking a simple one-minute risk test at doihaveprediabetes.org.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its pre-diabetes awareness partners.
Bet he can't say that in reverse.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week, April Young Bennett. She's the author of Ask a Suffragist, Stories and Wisdom from America's First Feminist. How can women today make their voices heard?
I think we need to look at what our foremothers did at a time when women were expected not to speak at all. And they were creative. In some cases, they were barred from men's proceedings. And so they held their own alternative conventions where they had maybe only women or maybe only women and men who supported them that were speaking at the same time. Other times they would show up in places where they were not welcome and make people listen to them. They would show up and just come in and stand there until someone heard them. And so there were many different ways that they reached out to places where they weren't welcome until finally public opinion started to change.
And how can women today have that effect?
I still see people doing the same strategies today. I'm involved. You mentioned the Exponent, one of the groups that I work with. That's a women's group made up of women of my faith, which is a very patriarchal faith. And so that's one way where we're banding together and making our voices heard as women by creating a women-centered space as an alternative to the patriarchal spaces that are provided to us by our faith community. And then coming in places where we're not welcome is another that we've done. One that I did was that as part of Ordained Women, we marched to a male-only meeting. There were hundreds of us women that came and said, we want to attend, we want to participate. And we arrived at the doors and asked for entrance.
And what happened?
Unfortunately, they did not let us in. They actually, we got in line and they refused us entry one at a time, just the women. The men were allowed to enter and the women were refused entry one at a time. And the next time we did it, they said, okay, this time we're still not going to let you in, but we'll let you listen over the internet. And that reminded me of exactly what happened to Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott when they went to the World Anti-Slavery Convention in London. They were allowed to listen behind a curtain, but they weren't allowed to participate.
What role may my brethren and I play in today's feminist movement?
I'm a firm believer that men can be feminists and that we need male feminists. When we look at history, we see that men who are already welcome in spaces where women weren't and who were already sitting in positions of power that women didn't yet have were in a unique place to use their privilege to help women. And many of them chose to do so. And that's what we need today as well.
And how can we balance family life and activism?
When we look in the past, if you actually ask, say, Susan B. Anthony, she would say, you can't. Please don't have kids. We really need you in the movement. Susan B. Anthony didn't like it when her suffragist peers would get married and have kids. However, the rest of them found many, many creative ways to make their voices heard as part of a family. And one of the most important things that they did was they found like-minded people to marry and have children with, people, male feminists, who also believed in the cause and were willing to support them and participate with them.
And how do you find that in your own family, your own relationship?
Many of us do. If we find our way to feminism young, we do eventually get a partner who is like-minded. For those of us who came into it later and maybe our partners aren't on the same page with us, there's a lot that we can do to help them to understand the need for women's rights, to help them to empathize, and to help them to eventually see the need. It's just a matter of patience and time, and sometimes in saying, okay, we're not going to agree with each other, but I've got a protest to go to, and I'll see you later.
You mentioned your challenge several years ago with the LDS and your opinions and your voice. Is religion compatible with the feminist movement?
Many people would say no. However, as a feminist of faith, many of the first other feminists that I met were people of my same religion. And the reason for that is because we are seeing the inequities firsthand. We're seeing what still happens, how women are still excluded, and we just naturally feel ready to address that. And so you'll find lots of people of faith who are working to change their religions and make them more open, more equal, more accommodating. And that benefits everyone. The people who did that now, people who did that in the past during the suffrage movement, as they opened doors within religions and made faith communities more equitable, that benefited everyone because that equality that people learn in their places of worship, it spills out into other parts of their lives. And so you need religious feminists to help you to make those changes.
How may women break the glass ceiling?
More and more every day. However, it's also a little bit depressing how far we haven't come. There still is a gender gap in wages. When we look at entrepreneurship, women are still only receiving 2% of the funding for their startups compared to what men are receiving. So there's a long way to go. But we do have many people from the suffrage movement who broke the glass ceiling at their time, opened doors, and thanks to them, we've got more and more opportunity today.
And how does art inspire the change that we seek?
When we remember people like Frances Ellen Watkins Harper and how she would go out and entertain the masses with her slam poetry, we see people doing the same thing today. They do it with music, they do it with film, they do it with subversive cross-stitching, they do it with everything. And a lot of times people are more willing to be entertained and learn that way than to be, say, scolded.
How should modern activists define their priorities? Where should they put their efforts?
One thing that we learned from the suffrage movement is something they didn't do so well. And that is they reached a point, actually they reached a point more than once, where women were competing with men of color to achieve their rights. And it was almost like they forgot that the enemy was patriarchy, not each other. And that is definitely the one thing you've got to make sure you're not doing when you define your priorities. You don't want to seek rights for yourself at the expense of some other disadvantaged group. We all need to build up each other and come forward together. So that's an important thing to remember that I think we're still working on.
And what other things should they do?
They should also look at what is the root of the problem? Where does it come from? Where does it start? Because sometimes we have to look at what's the most important thing. One thing during the suffrage movement that many were very passionate about was dress reform. At the time, everyone was wearing these corsets and petticoats and long dresses that were uncomfortable and made it very difficult for them to move into male-dominated professions because they just weren't dressed right. So there were some women who were very passionate about the idea that women should be allowed to wear pants. And I agree with them. I think they were completely right that women should be allowed to wear pants. Today we are, thankfully. And they fought for this for a little while until they found that the street harassment was so distracting when they were wearing pants in public. They called them bloomers at the time. It was a specific kind of pants that they couldn't promote the other issues they cared about. They couldn't give speeches about suffrage because all people would notice was their pants, and they would only talk about their pants. Nobody would talk to them about suffrage. And so they had to step back and say, as much as we're right about this issue, we need to think about which other issues we care about more, because our work towards this issue is blocking our ability to promote the other causes we really care about.
I remember the feminist movement of the 1960s and 1970s, and I remember there was a lot of anger voiced, and rightfully so, righteous anger. Does anger have a place in today's movement?
Yes, all human emotions have a place in every movement. But there is a difference. Sometimes anger will impede your ability to get through. Some people won't listen to anger. That's always going to be the case. However, one of the things that women and other disadvantaged communities have fought for a long time is the ability to actually say what they think. And a lot of times when we look at these inequities, we feel angry, and people have been working for a long time for us to have the right to say, I'm angry.
How should modern activists emulate the suffragists?
One of the things that we can do that they did is they were diverse, they were different from each other, just like we are today, and yet they reached out. They tried to find other people who cared about these issues, even if they were approaching them in different ways, even if they had different priorities, and they looked for ways they could work together. And that's something I think we need to do today, too. We always need to be looking for ways to expand our horizons, work with people who are different from us, who are diverse, and come together towards common causes, even if we are working in different ways.
Work together, organize, communicate.
Absolutely.
What would you like readers to take away from Ask a Suffragist?
I hope that after they read this, they feel inspired by the people who came before us and how much they were able to accomplish against all the odds, and they feel energized to go out and fight for those causes they believe in. And I hope also they will see that they weren't perfect. These were flawed people, passionate people, but flawed people who did make some mistakes along the way. And I hope as we know our history, we'll stop repeating our mistakes so often. We'll be able to learn from the past. We'll be able to take what they did right and keep on doing it and do it more. And also try to avoid some of those mistakes that may have already happened in the past.
Her name is April Young Bennett. She's the author of Ask a Suffragist, Stories and Wisdom from America's First Feminist. April, please tell us one more time where listeners can get your book and find out more about you and your work.
The book is available wherever good books are sold. If you go to askasuffragist.com, you can link to bookstores that are selling the book and, of course, Amazon. And again, I would encourage you to get the book during the first month, because then you can also get the illustrated companion that goes with the book.
And that's available to listeners who buy the book during the month of June. Is that correct?
That's correct.
April, thank you so much for joining us. The book is wonderful. The message is so important. And I ask that my brethren who are listening tonight also get the book and read it, in addition to the women who are part of the movement. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.